Okay. So how does this, so there is, this is sort of more of the abstract way to think about this. So if you take any object, there has a set of access rights on that object. Okay. Access rights basically say this is the name of the object and that's the set of rights that you have on this object. Okay. So the right set is essentially all the operations that can be performed on this object. Okay. So here is object O1, where you can do read or write, object O2, you can do execute, and so on and so forth. Okay, so for every object, a set of operations you can do. Okay, so those operations can be associated with entities, and those entities will dictate who can do what in the system. Okay, so let's just take a very somewhat concrete example. Okay, in the context of Unix, there are two so-called domains. Okay, these are groups of, think of them as groups of users. Okay, so there's a supervisor domain. Okay, that's really the root on the machine or the super user. And then there are actual users, or that this one is also called administrator, supervisor. Okay. These two groups of users have different rights and what they can and cannot do in the system. Okay, typically, in Unix or most operating systems, as if you are a supervisor, administrator, root, you can do pretty much anything. Okay, you can delete files, you can do or modify any object, have access to low-level objects and so on. Okay, if you are an ordinary user in the system, then you can do a more limited set of things. Okay, so that's really the way, and different users, so there may be more than one user in the system, and different users may have different levels of rights. Okay, so in the context of Unix, basically we use this notion of a user ID to figure out who can do what. Okay, every user, whether it's a super user or an ordinary user, has an ID associated with it. Him or her. Okay? And there are basically rights associated with each user ID. Okay? Typically, super user gets ID 0. Okay? That automatically tells the system that if the ID is 0, pretty much have carte blanche to do whatever you want on this system. Okay? The system will not stop you from doing something. Okay? And other users will have specific rights and privileges. Okay? Typically, Unix enforces these rights through a file system. Okay, each file has essentially a domain bit associated with it. It's called a set UID bit. Whenever the file is executed, okay, the set UID, and if that set UID bit is on, then the user ID is basically becomes the owner, equal to the owner of that file. Okay, and I'll explain what that means in just a moment. Let's look through some more examples and then we can come back to that. Okay. There are many ways to figure out domains and roles and so on in a system. This is a very old example from an ancient operating system called Multics that came up with this idea where they said you can basically have an expanding role or set of privileges in the system. Okay? So you have this notion of a ring, okay? And each ring is basically has some rights associated. And then if you basically, as you expand, you have all the rights of the ring inside you plus some more. So in case of Unix, you can think of just two rings, a user and super user. Super user can do everything and the user can do some smaller subset of it. Multics has a more general framework where you can have something called ring 0 and ring 1 and so on all the way to ring n minus 1. Okay? The basic idea is for each of these circles, you basically associate a list of things that anybody who belongs to that group can do, set of access rights. Okay. And then if you are in an outer ring, then you basically inherit everything that the inner ring gives you and some more privileges. Okay. So this is one way to think about it. This is essentially set operators. Okay. So you can implement this as sets, and then basically as you go outwards, you have the set of rights, you have a superset of whatever was given to somebody who's in an inner ring. Okay. This is one way to think about access rights. Okay. Another and a slightly more intuitive way to think about access rights is through what is called an access matrix. Okay. So in this case, rows represent domains or users. Okay. Domain and user is somewhat synonymous in this discussion. Okay. The term domain, it comes more from a security literature. Here, think of whenever I say domain, think user. Okay. Columns represent objects. Objects could be files, disks, resources of some sort. Okay. And then you have matrix. An element of that, many item in that matrix essentially tells us what rights a domain has on an object. So here is an example. Okay, this is an access matrix. Okay. So here these rows represent domains, or let's say think of them as users, user 1, user 2, user 3, user 4. Columns represents objects. Okay, here is a file 1, file 2, file 3, printer, and so on. Okay. So here the entry here essentially says what can this user do on this object. So if the OS had this matrix available to it, whenever some process tries to execute an operation, you say whose process is it, which user started that process, and then you take that operation and look at the object you are trying to access and look at this entry and say, is this operation allowed or not? If the entry says read, only read is user D3 can only read F2 but not write to it, for example. Okay? So you could maintain this access matrix where you have domains or users, okay, this could be groups as well, okay, and you have objects, okay, and then each element on the matrix tells you what operations can be performed. Yes.
So if there's something there, I guess in this diagram, that means that you just can't do anything.
Yes. If there's no, if this is blank, that means this user has no rights on this object whatsoever. You cannot read, write. It may be somebody else's file, for instance. Okay. So that's an access matrix. So now you can sort of think about how the OS should go about figuring out whether operations are allowed or not. Anytime you do a read, write, open of a file, you essentially look at the process, you associate a process with a domain or a user, you look at the operation that is being performed, and you look at the specific entry and say, should I allow or not allow? And then you can allow or deny. So every operation has to go through this check. These entries can change on the fly. Okay, so if the entry changes, and then you can, may have to allow or deny based on whatever the change in the entry is. Okay, so that's basically what says, if a process in domain D tries to do a certain operation, that operation must be present in the access matrix, otherwise you deny it. Okay, and as I said, you can essentially change these entries dynamically. Okay, the most simplest way to think about how you can change it is you can change permissions on files. That would change entries here. Okay, you can allow some users to do some additional operations or remove certain privileges from some users. Okay, that changes these entries. Okay, now the two ways to the most operating system don't actually keep this entire matrix around. Okay, what they do is they either keep columns of the matrix or rows of the matrix. Okay? And depending on which one you do, you get what is called an access control list, or you get what is called a capability list. Okay, so if you have a column, you maintain columns, then you get an access control list. Okay, so if you basically keep this column, okay, that basically is, and you associate that column with that file, that's an access control list. Okay, so you associate this privileges with that file, and that says that, so with that, basically when you look at the ACL for that file, it will say that D1 can read and D3 can execute and so on. Okay? So that's what you typically see in many operating systems are ACLs. Okay? Those are essentially columns that are maintained and they're associated with individual objects. So you don't actually have this global matrix sitting somewhere. You chop the matrix up into columns and columns are associated with objects. Okay. Now, there's a completely different way of designing an operating system where you associate rows rather than columns. Okay? So, in this case, there are no permissions associated with any objects. Rather, you have a set of rights associated with each domain or user. Okay? So, every user has a list. Okay? That list specifies exactly what that user can and cannot do in the system. Okay? So, for so if you are user D4, you will be given this list. Okay, so you don't actually, there are no columns maintained, there are only rows maintained. Okay? So if this user wants to then access file F3, it has to present its list saying, look, I have permission to access this file because that's the read and write permissions in my list. Okay, this is called a capability. Okay? Users present capabilities when they try to do an operation, saying I have the permission to do this or privileges to do this. Okay? So there are operating systems that maintain this row order. Most commercial operating systems that we have encountered don't actually maintain rows. They actually keep this access matrix in terms of columns. Okay? But there are systems out there that actually keep this in terms of rows. Okay? So the thing to keep in mind is, in one case, we get what is called an access control list. Okay? So that's columns that are associated with objects. In another case, you get essentially something called a capability list. Okay, so these are operations that are associated with domains. You get two different ways of designing an operating system. Okay, you can guess which is the more popular way. Okay, that's pretty much all that you see in most operating systems, not this. Okay, so there are reasons for efficiency and so on as to why access control lists have become more popular than capabilities. In case of capabilities, harder to reason about what to do and who gets access to it and so on and so forth. Okay, so if you create a file, so think about if you have to actually name all the users and give them entries that they have to put into their capability list. It's much easier because you are the owner of the file to specify who has access to what with the file itself. Okay, so things are a little simpler if you have access control lists over capabilities. Okay. The two systems that actually came up with this idea, mostly research systems, they never became popular. This operating system called Hydra. I think both were designed in Europe. Okay, there's a CAP system. Okay, that's where the term capability came from. CAP was short for capabilities. Okay, so those actually came up with this idea, saying here's a different way to go about thinking about protection and so on. Okay, yes, question.
Do operating systems outlined in like the old beige book, military classified structure fall under the capability list, or does it fall under a special case of an access control list? Because everyone could read at a certain level,
right,
but they could save at a higher level, but each file was essentially instantiated at a level on creation.
Right. So if you are associating permissions with files, that definite, that automatically makes it an access control list. Okay. If you had users who could pretty much show up and say, look, I have a right to access, to enter, to do something, that's a capability list. Okay? So there are many other non-computer system scenarios where capabilities are the right things. Okay? Think about buildings and keys. Okay? You have a key, so you can actually unlock the building and get in. Okay? You don't show up and then ask the lock saying, am I allowed to enter and enter? That's not the way it actually works. So there are many, these systems, I think, real keys and protection of physical buildings, you go in a different way than what you do in computer system. Yes.
So when you make a new user, I assume that just kind of gets the default privileges, but does it have to, like, update all the permissions for every single file?
Right. So the question is, if you're a new user, you get some default permission, do you have to go and update anything to a file? So that's the nice thing about keeping these in columns is, if you're a user, yeah, and you basically add a row to this matrix, and initially the row is going to be empty.
Yeah.
Because unless there are files that are specifically said anybody can read, write, execute, then you inherit something by default. But you don't have to actually go and change anything. Okay, to file, because the files will be, if you try to open a file, it will just check that entry, saying, do you have any permission? If your thing is empty, then you won't be allowed to do it. Any other questions? Okay, so the two takeaways, really the takeaways are that operating systems need to keep this matrix, it's logical matrix. Physically, you don't keep this as a matrix. You either maintain rows or columns. Okay, the matrix is called access control matrix. There are users or domains and objects or files, and then elements of it tell you which one it is. And most of the time, you know, operating systems, we see the column-based organization. The columns are equivalent to access control list. Okay. And as you can imagine, in Unix, Unix has access control list, but a coarser representation of it. Basically, there is the owner, group, and world. There are three groups that you can associate with any object, whether it's a file or a device and so on. There's the owner, what is then the group that user belongs to, or that object belongs to, and everyone else, which is world. And you basically can specify read, write, execute privileges with each of these two groups. Okay. It's a much coarser representation of an access control list, where there are three predefined groups. Okay. The owner of the object, a group to which that object belongs to, okay, and everyone else. Okay. Somewhat less flexible. Okay. You can actually do whatever you want with this scenario that you can do with access control is by forming groups of arbitrary sets of users on the fly and associating different permissions. Okay, much more compact, somewhat coarser approximation of access control. Okay, so with every object, you basically specify this permission. When you create a new file or object, there may be some default permissions which you are allowed to change if you are the owner of the object. Okay. Now, I should mention that there is that's the operating system level protection. There are languages also that have their own protection mechanisms. Okay. So, the language itself can have built-in protection. A good example of this is Java. Okay. So, Java classes have protection built in. So, whenever you sort of create a class or an object that is basically as a class, you have a protection domain associated with it. Okay? The protection domain sort of indicates what operation can be performed and cannot be performed. Okay? There are reasonable defaults. So, when you write your application, you don't actually worry about it. But if you look at the Java spec, you will actually see that you can have different protection roles associated with objects in your program. Okay? Most of the time, you don't actually use any of them. Okay? But that's really what you can do if you try to use that flexibility. Okay, so in particular, if your library methods that invoke some privileged operation, you do the right checks and see if you have the privileges to do it. And if not, you're going to basically ensure that the operation doesn't proceed. Okay. So these are examples of languages that also have protection mechanisms built in. Okay, typically, we assume that things are only done at the operating system level. But there are language features as well that you see in some modern languages that have protection mechanisms. So you can implement protection at a language level as well. Okay. So that was a very quick overview of protection. I didn't want to ignore this topic because it is a set of chapters in the book. So, and I had not said anything about it. Well, the question is if the language implements protection, is the compiler creating a role or a row or a column? So what happens is this has to be done at runtime, okay, because it has to be associated with objects. Objects are actually created when you run the program, okay, whenever you run a constructor, for instance. Okay. So when a new object is instantiated, the runtime, in this case, is the Java virtual machine, but it could be some other runtime, is responsible for doing this. Okay, so it's the responsibility of the runtime system, not so much the compiler. Okay, the runtime system roughly does what the OS would do. Object is created, it will create an access control list, a protection domain, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's all I have to say. It's a very brief overview of protection system. There are only two or three concepts that are really worth taking away: access control list, capabilities, access matrices, and so on. And if you know those, then you can pretty much reason about what can be done, cannot be done, etc. Okay. So what I'll do now is to spend the next half hour or so doing a wrap up and a review. Okay. I already mentioned that the final exam is cumulative or comprehensive, but there will be more emphasis on the material that we have covered since midterm 2, which is file systems, I/O systems, and distributed systems. Okay. Process management and memory management, there will be less emphasis, but it is going to some, there will be some questions on the test. Okay. So that's the thing to keep in mind. Standard closed book, closed notes. Okay, exam is 2 hours, not 90 minutes. That's the standard time for a final exam. Okay. So you'll get a little more time to finish. Okay, so let me start with process management. This was a while ago, so it's good refresher. So we talked about what is a process. Okay, it's basically an address space with an execution context. Okay. We talked about how processes are created, the states of a process. This was starting with new, you can have ready running all of those things to, as you go from one state to another. We talked about scheduling of processes where the CPU gives each process a certain time slot. If your time slot expires or you block on doing I/O or block on a synchronization primitive, you basically have to relinquish the CPU and then you switch, the OS is going to switch to another process. So that's referred to as a context switch. Okay. So you should know what happens during a context switch. You have to save the execution state of that process into the PCB, choose a new process to execute, load the execution state of that other process. Execution state of the register, memory management information, file management information, TLB, all of the stuff that we have talked about through the course. You should know what is a process and what is a thread. You can have multiple threads of execution going through the same address space. And in that case, you get what's called a multi-threaded process. And when we say process, by default, we assume there's only one thread of execution. Because in some sense, a single-threaded process is what we mean by a process. But we generalize that notion and we get this concept of a thread. We talked about different kinds of threads, user level, kernel level. Talked about the pros and cons of having user level threads which are implemented in libraries versus kernel level thread for which there is OS support. Okay. Then we talked about scheduling of processes and threads. We went through a number of different policies, starting with first come, first serve, round robin, multi-level feedback, queue shortest, job first, and so on. Okay, in this context, we differentiated the scheduling algorithms as preemptive or non-preemptive. Okay, preemptive processes are ones that can be interrupted by the CPU, specifically for scheduling across time quanta. Non-preemptive processes, once you get run on the CPU, the OS doesn't get to make you relinquish the CPU. You have to relinquish it when either the process terminates or you do some I/O, okay, there's an interrupt. Okay, so you should know which of these are preemptive and which ones are not. So there are preemptive versions of most of them. Okay, FCFS is the only one that's really non-preemptive. Okay, we talked about I/O bound processes and CPU bound processes. Okay, I/O bound processes are those that spend most of their time doing I/O. CPU-bound processes are the ones that spend most of their time doing computation. Okay. And the reason we went into that detail is that from a scheduling perspective, it matters whether a process is I/O-bound or CPU-bound. Specifically, we said we should be giving more preferential treatment to I/O-bound processes. Okay. The reason being, if they become ready to run, they will run for a short period of time and go back to doing I/O. CPU-bound processes will sit and hog the CPU. Okay, so you should always try to, the I/O bound process becomes ready to run, give it the CPU soon so that it can go back to doing I/O. Okay. And we looked at specific policies that actually provide this kind of differentiation. Okay, shortest job first was an example, an ideal one which you cannot implement in practice, that gives priority to shorter jobs, which tend to be I/O bound jobs because they only run for short periods of time. And then we talked about multi-level feedback queue that tries to approximate shortest job first and specifically gives priority to shorter jobs. It has multiple queues. You know what MLFQ does by now. Okay, multiple queue implemented it in the lab. So you have multiple queues. Each queue has a different quantum. Priorities drop as you go down the queue. Okay, and you do essentially priority scheduling at across queues and round robin within a queue. Okay, that's MLFQ. So we also then spent quite a bit of time, as a matter of fact, doing synchronization, okay, all of which had to do with implementing synchronization for multi-threaded program. Okay, we looked at semaphores, locks, and monitors. Okay, there was a question on monitors in the exam, and I remember that many of you were still not clear on what monitors were. I hope by now that confusion has gone away with lab 3 and all of the stuff you have done since then. Okay. So go back and review synchronization. Okay. Not just for the final exam, but it's an important concept to keep in mind. As you write any multi-threaded program, you need to know how to actually do proper synchronization. Okay. Without that, your program will have lots of bugs in race condition. Okay. So just coming back to the review, we'll talk about two types of semaphores, counting semaphores, binary semaphore. Binary semaphore is the same as a lock. Counting semaphore allows you to protect multiple resources. Counting semaphores also allows you to impose ordering. Okay, there was a question on that as well in the exam, if you remember, where you could take two pieces of code and explicitly order in which order they run. Okay, that you can do with a counting semaphore. Okay. Locks basically is a simple synchronization primitive you have to acquire before entering a critical section and release when you exit. Okay. And monitor inside is a higher level construct. Okay. Basically makes your job of writing synchronization code easier because locks are built in. So you don't explicitly have to lock, unlock. You let the runtime system do it. Okay. Just as in Java, you can make any class into a monitor by using the word synchronized. Okay. And then that allows the runtime to automatically grab logs for you. Condition variables are constructs that allow you to release the log that you've acquired atomically and go to sleep. And then you can be woken up at a later time. The reason we looked at all of this was to understand from an OSS perspective how you implement these primitives. Okay, that really was the goal. So we saw various ways to implement this technique, starting from enabling and disabling interrupts, okay, using test and set instructions. Okay, these are atomic instructions that are implemented in the hardware. Okay, so you need to really understand, I mean, once you understand the concepts, really how do you go about implementing them inside. Okay, so that's really something to keep in mind. In that context, we encounter the notion of busy waiting, okay, which basically makes you wait for a condition to become true. You know, we saw that when we did enabling and disabling interrupts. Okay. And then we spent some time talking about various form, sort of generic problems in synchronization. Reader-writer problems, producer-consumer problem, dining philosopher's problem. Okay. These you will again encounter as you solve real problems. Okay. So they look like toy problems, but they are actually sort of derived from many, many scenarios where the same problems occur over and over again. Okay? So understanding what they are and how they work is also something that you need to know. Okay? And we spent some time doing deadlock. Your question?
No.
Okay. So we spent some time looking at this issue of deadlocks. Should know what are deadlocks, how they differ from starvation, okay? Necessary conditions for a deadlock. Okay? And then how do you deal with deadlocks? Okay, we talked about deadlock prevention, avoidance, and deadlock recovery. Okay, so in the first case, you impose some conditions so that one of the four necessary conditions is false, so there is never a chance to have a deadlock in the system. Okay, so you basically ensure that there will be no deadlocks to begin with. The second case, you basically say, we will not impose those restrictions, but at runtime, we will check, saying if a request comes in saying grant me this resource, we will check whether granting that request is going to potentially result in a deadlock. And if you go into an unsafe state, then you will deny that request, even though the resource may be available. Okay. And the last case is the lazy case where you say, I don't do anything upfront, I don't check at runtime, I will solve the problem after it has occurred, which is I will periodically check if many threads are blocked, not making progress, I will assume there's a deadlock and terminate, reboot. Some such thing. Okay. As I said, in operating systems, you basically don't have any features for deadlocks, handling deadlock. Okay. It's left to the users because it's too complex. But there are many other systems where you do have to implement this. Real code that you write, systems like databases and so on. Okay. You can't have code getting into deadlock when you write real apps. Okay. So that's the reason you need to know about what are deadlocks and how do you deal with them. Okay, any questions on this before I move on to memory management? Okay, that was the first quarter of the course. Okay, process management, processes, threads, synchronization, deadlocks, all of that. Okay. Next part was on memory management. Okay, so here we talked about many different schemes to do memory management, starting with very simple contiguous allocation, where you allocate entire contiguous chunks of memory to a process. We looked at static and dynamic relocation scheme. We looked at the problems, external fragmentation, internal fragmentation. We looked at how do you deal with it through compaction and so on. And then we looked at other techniques like paging, where you allocate memory in fixed size chunks, get rid of fragmentation. Okay. We looked at segmentation, which is the OS compiler's view of the process, and then combined for segmentation and paging. Okay. Sequence of techniques, okay, starting from contiguous allocation, paging, segmentation, segmented paging. You need to understand the differences between all of those. Okay. Then the last technique we looked at was virtual memory and demand paging. So in the context of virtual memory, we said the process doesn't need to be resident in RAM at all times. It's resident on disk. You fetch pages on demand, okay, and service those requests, service these page requests whenever they occur. And we talked about the 90-10 rule. It's a 90% of the time. I don't remember if it was 90-10 or 80-20, one of those two rules. So basically it says most of the time your process accesses a small set of pages called its working set. And because you have this kind of behavior, you can get away with demand paging. If page accesses were random, demand paging would never work. Okay? Because whatever you fetch is not a good guess of what your process is going to access next, because you are accessing pages at random. So you will have a lot of page faulting and performance will collapse. The only reason you get away with this is program, well-behaved programs actually don't access pages at random. They actually work on small groups of pages at a time and then move on to the next group of pages. With that behavior, you can actually implement demand paging and virtual memory and get good performance. Okay, So that's basically where we talked about demand paging. In those contexts, we looked at many optimization. TLBs, translation lookaside buffers that allow you to keep page table entries and so on. Okay, and then we talked about page replacement algorithms. Basically, if you have page faults, what page do you fetch and what page do you evict? Okay, so we looked at FIFO, min, LRU, and several approximations. Okay, second chance, we looked at two different variants. Okay, you should understand why you need those approximations. And I said the reason being implementing any of these basic schemes is very expensive in practice. Okay, you don't want to slow down your system. Okay, that's page replacement. Okay, then we switched to I/O systems and file systems. Okay, so that was the next component of the course. Okay, so we talked about I/O devices. We looked at different kinds of I/O devices, some that communicate by simple polling. Okay, there are four registers. Okay, a canonical I/O device has four registers: a register to write the data, a register to read the data, a register to issue a command to the device, and a register to look at the results of your command. Okay, these are basically how you communicate with any generic device. Okay, you send a command to the command register, and you can read or write data based on your command. Okay, so that was one. We talked about DMA, which allows you to have faster devices that allow you to read or write chunks of data, not one byte at a time. Okay, you should understand the notion of direct memory access, how it works, and so on. Okay, so that's basically how does the OS communicate with OS I/O devices, polling, DMA, and asynchronous I/O. So we also looked at how do you optimize the performance of slow devices using buffering and caching. I/O devices by definition are slow, CPU is fast. So you basically cache recently accessed data from that I/O devices in RAM. So if you access it again, you don't have to go back to that device. It's cached in memory. So I/O buffers are used to deal with the speed mismatches between a fast CPU and a slow device. Okay, so that's how you can sort of mitigate the impact of these slow devices. We looked at policies that allow you to trade performance and efficiency, performance and reliability, excuse me. So we looked at if you have a buffer, you can do write through or write back policy. Write through policy says whenever you do I/O or write, you basically write all the way to the device, safer to do. Write back says you just write to the OS buffer and return. Okay, it's faster. But then if your machine crashes before it data is written or data is lost. So whenever you have any form of caching, you will have to decide between write through and write back. When we did distributed file systems, we looked at the same issue that we looked at in I/O devices. Okay. So then we looked at how do you manage these I/O devices, and we looked at one specific one, which was the disk. We said disks are slow, disks spin, the track head has to move back and forth, so you need to somehow schedule your requests that are going to disk to reduce the wasted time in doing seeks and rotational latency. Okay, so you need to understand the notion of a seek, a rotational latency, transfer time, okay, and then how you can optimize these overheads using these algorithms. Okay, there's a FIFO, shortest seek time first, scan and C-scan. Okay, scan and C-scans are equivalent of elevator scheduling. Okay, you just scan back and forth from the lowest track to the highest track and schedule, or not schedule, service requests as you encounter them. Okay? Understanding them, trying to take a stream of requests, schedule them, you need to be able to know how it gets scheduled. Yes, I mentioned this already. Okay, so next component was on file system. So you need to know what is a file, what is the type of a file, how is the type of a file used. When you open a file, if you have a file type, the OS knows what application to associate with it. Okay. You need to know how all these system calls, open, close, create, read, write, are actually executed. We looked at pseudocode for each of those as to what happens. There's a notion of a file descriptor, per process descriptor, global descriptor, what they are used for. Okay. All of this you need to understand. We talked about directories as a way to organize files. Okay. And then we looked at this notion of creating hard links and soft links so that you can associate multiple names with a file. Okay. Links are a way, referential naming is a way to associate multiple names. Okay. We looked at when soft links are allowed and when hard links are allowed and so on. Okay. And then we went into the disk itself and said, how does the file system lay out data on disks? Okay, so we looked at three specific policies. Contiguous allocation, okay, which is only used on things like CD-ROMs and DVD-ROMs, okay, because the files don't change once you create them, so you can allocate them contiguously. And the other two, which are somewhat more common, are linked list organization and multi-level index files. Okay, in Unix, we have a multi-level index organization called inode or index node, where you have an index which has pointers to blocks of the file. So if you want to access block I, you have to look up this index, see where block I is stored, and then go to that block and retrieve it. Okay? And we said it's a multi-level index so that you can have good performance for small files where you have direct block pointer, and progressively slower performance for larger and larger files. It's like progressive tax. Yeah, as you become bigger, you are taxed more in the overhead incurred to accessing your data. Okay, so that's the philosophy used for multi-level index files. Okay, so this I already did. So the next part of the course was the final part was on distributed systems. Okay, so we do need to know what is a distributed system, okay, how it differs from a parallel system. In a distributed system, you have multiple machines connected by a network, the parallel multiple CPUs connected by a network, the parallel system with multiple cores inside a machine. Okay, we also refer to them as tightly and loosely coupled system. Okay, one is more tightly coupled, they share a system bus, others are loosely coupled, they share a network. Okay. Advantages of distributed systems, we said they enable resource sharing. You can take a resource on a machine and share it on another machine, share printer, share files and so on. He said you can improve performance, have more machines to run your applications on. If you have n machines, you can get n times speed up, can get better reliability. If one machine in the system crashes, other machines can take over that job so that the application as a whole continues to run. Okay, many different advantages of distributed systems. Okay. There are disadvantages as well. System becomes more complex, because you have to now write your application to run on multiple machines. You are open to security attacks because your machines sit on a network. They are vulnerable to attacks and so on. Okay, so there are some disadvantages as well. Okay. We talked a little bit about networks. Okay, there was a quick refresher I did. I introduced several concepts, local area network, like Ethernet, wide area network. These are networks that connect machines over much larger distances. Topologies for LAN and WAN. We looked at ring topology, star topology, tree topology, fully connected topology, bus-based topology, which are Ethernet and so on. Okay? So understanding and ring topology, understanding what these topologies imply from the perspective of number of messages needed to traverse from the source to destination, whether the network topology is resilient to link failures and so on. Understanding that is important. And then we looked a little bit at the protocol stack. I quickly talked about the TCP/IP protocol stack, transport layer protocols like TCP/UDP, concept of a packet, okay, and how you have this layered organization, okay, of your protocol stack inside a kernel. Okay, this I did very quickly. I mentioned how you can share resources by using data migration or computation migration. In one case, data migrates to where the computation is. In another case, you send the program to where the data is. Okay, and in both cases, you can have client-server organization for implementing a distributed application. I said RPCs or remote procedure calls are a good way to implement client-server apps where you use the abstraction of calling a method for implementing a distributed application. Just so happens that the method lives on a different machine, not on your local machine. Then some explicit network message has to be sent to the server machine to execute the method and get the results. Okay. So how do RPCs work? What does the programmer have to do and what does the runtime system give you? All of the hard work is really done in the runtime system. Finding where the server is, using a directory service, constructing messages, establishing connection to the server, all that is hidden from you. Okay, just as you saw in the lab, you didn't actually have to establish raw sockets and so on. The RMI system took care of that for you. Okay. So RPCs and RMIs allow you to program at a higher level of abstraction so that you can worry more about the functionality of your program rather than lower level details of the network. Okay, that's really the philosophy behind why RPCs are popular or why they were designed. Okay. Next topic in distributed systems was file systems, distributed file systems. We talked about how a server can make files available on it to other clients, so you can now access files stored on different machines. Okay. In that context, we looked at naming, which is how you use file names to access these remote files. We introduced this notion of location transparency, where the name of the file does not reveal its location. And location independence, which says if the file actually moves for any reason and the file name doesn't change. Okay. He said most file systems are location transparent, but not necessarily location independent. The file moves from one machine to another, its name might change. Okay. But there are some systems that provide both, which are which makes them somewhat better from a user standpoint. Okay. We basically looked at the notion of a global namespace, where a file can be accessed using one name regardless of which machine you come from, or relative namespaces like in NFS, where you have mount points and depending on how volumes are mounted on that file system, you may get different names for your file. Okay. So understanding this notion of namespaces is important. We talked about caching in a distributed file system. We said there are two models to actually access remote file. The remote access model, where read-write requests are sent to the server, or the caching model, where the first time you open the file, you bring it over, and all the subsequent requests are local. Okay, so these are two different ways you can implement a typical file system, remote access or caching-oriented. If you have caching-oriented implementations, you have to deal with problems of consistency. Two machines access the same file, how do you ensure that the writes are consistent? If one writes, how does the other one get notified? You have to send requests from the server to tell clients that file has changed, for instance. Okay. And then in this context as well, you can have write back or write through caching. If you do write through, every time you write to a cache, you have to actually propagate that write to the server. In write back, you only make local changes and once in a while you flush. Okay. And we then looked at NFS as a use case or a case study, and looked at how some of the design decisions are implemented in NFS. Okay, that's Sun's network file system. And today I did this topic on protection. We just defined what is protection and how you implement it using access matrices, access control lists, and capabilities. Okay, so that's really what we have as far as the course is concerned. Once again, the exam is similar flavor to most of the midterms. There's no difference. Yeah, there will be some questions where you will be asked to explain a concept, define a concept, some questions where you are asked to solve some small problems, saying under this scenario what might happen and so on. Okay, no coding to be done. I did not include or will not include a synchronization question. We did one already. So there's no pseudocode really to write at all. So, and of course, there are never any questions about any specific OSs. Okay, those are only meant as case studies. So, that is basically what we have for the course. Okay, I'm going to pause here to see if there are any final questions about the exam or any of this material that you have before we end. Yes, I will. Shortly. It's not yet up there. I was preparing it at the last minute, but I will put it up today. All the lecture notes are up there. Videos are up there if you missed classes. The slides are always there. So I think the usual advice stands, start from the slides, look at what has been covered in class, then look at the notes, and then use the book or the video if you have some concept is not clear. Okay, I would basically do the same thing what we had discussed last time. Okay, so I think that's it. Hope you had good experience with this course. Feel free to send me your comments even afterwards if you have any suggestions on what you would have liked to see, have seen, etc. Okay, we can use that to improve it in the future. Okay, so let's end it here.